Awesome. Go for it.
Okay. And it's from a lady in Poland. Her name's Maria. And she
Hi,
said,
Maria.
"All my teachers, I bow to myself and my mind, my emotions and my current view of the world for the work that you have done. I use 1 to 3 sheets a day because my emotional state does not allow me to experience more. I have been using meditation at the end of each sheet for 14 days." And she's using the meditation of the sorry, forgive me, thank you, I love you. "This makes my 30th day in the desert. Since yesterday, at the point where I had to describe how I wanted to punish the person in worksheet, a place for what he caused in me, at that point I smiled. With all my being and heart, I already understand, and there is nothing left to fix. Does this mean that I am approaching the mirage that is paradise on earth? I don't know. You know more. I am still crying with emotion. I know that I would translate both the worksheet and Michael's book into my native language, which is Polish, because it is a priceless treasure for the people of the world. I still don't know how to put my thoughts into words or how I feel with my whole being. I disappeared into silence, but it's like bathing my soul in light, and I remain alone to touch."
Well, holding the space for you, that's powerful. Thank you for sharing that with us, and that it's having that impact on you. And it'd be wonderful if you would translate the book. It'd be awesome to have the book available in Polish. That would be just fabulous. And as far as the meditation that is referred to as Ho'oponopono, I have some thoughts to share with anybody that's doing that. Actually, we just set up a page on the website for the reply, or for my our thinking on that Hawaiian process that's offered as forgiveness. And in the context of first century Aramaic forgiveness, there's some things about the Ho'oponopono that are off base, at least the way that it's thought. And so the and some of the reasoning behind that, and why I'd suggest that you make some shifts with that. And Jeannie went ahead and sent you a copy of this, but the I'm sorry part, my experience is that people who say I'm sorry become sorry people. And so we suggest deleting those words totally from your vocabulary. Like, never say the words I'm sorry ever again. And instead, we have what we call the apology tool. And recognize that since words are one of the ways we put energy into creation, sorry is not something that you want to focus on or create from. So the apology tool in the why work includes ownership of the conflict and the error. I made an error. I apologize for my error. And in the future, I will. And into the apology, speak what it is that you're going to do to correct the error. When two people join in mind energy, they strengthen the field of the mind energy of each of them. So, if I tell you what I'm sorry about, of course, I have to focus on or say what I'm sorry about. And if you're going to actually receive it, then you're going to tend to focus on the same thing. So now we have two minds focused on what we're sorry about. Not the best way to change the dynamic of the mind. So you want to speak, along with the apology, the ownership, speak into the creation and your connection with that other person, what the replacement behavior is going to be. The please forgive me idea that's put out there perpetuates the error that I'm supposed to let you off the hook, or you're supposed to let me off the hook for the pain that, if it's present in either of us, is an experience clearly generated from energies held within each of us. So for me to let you off the hook and call that forgiveness means that I will never do my forgiveness work, because I think I've already done it when I said, okay, I let you off the hook. So again, I suggest you delete the words I forgive you, never say the words again to anybody. If you choose to pardon somebody, great, pardon them. Call it what it is, and then recognizing that you're responsible for your pain, then step into the actual forgiveness process. But if I think I've already done it, then obviously I'm not going to step into the real forgiveness work. And basically, I've spent the last 40-plus years, bringing the technology of first-century Aramaic forgiveness to the world. And the Why Is This Happening to You Again workshop shows precisely how denied, internally generated pain is convincingly projected into our brain's image of another, and how to directly access and remove, that is, forgive the offending energy from one's own mind and body. That's what forgiveness is about. So if I let somebody else off the hook, it's not likely I'm going to now go inside and say, okay, so now I've caused my pain here, and I'm going to get rid of the energy with which I do that. And that's where the real forgiveness work is. So what most of the world calls forgiveness has nothing whatsoever to do with actual forgiveness, but is a Greek substitute, pardoning, again, letting others off the hook. And while that's certainly an okay thing to do, it's not forgiveness, which is a strictly internal act that involves no one but the person doing the forgiveness. Using the words, I forgive you, accomplishes the act of letting the other off the hook, but leaves actual forgiveness undone. And so, and Jeannie will put in the notes, and she sent a link to you, and it's a link to the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, the latest version of it. And that shows how to access and remove those energies that are causing one's pain. And there's also, and I'm sure Jeannie will be putting this in the notes, there's also a PowerPoint that diagrams the mechanics of forgiveness and what it accomplishes, how it works. And if we listen to Yeshua, he says, the power of life and death is in your words. So 2,000 years ago, what he was telling us is that perception, cellular chemistry, our emotions, and our creative process, everything is regulated by speech. Power of life and death. Vladimir Lenin, the man responsible for more deaths on planet Earth than probably anybody in history, said the way to destroy a culture is by changing the meaning of its words. Why do you suppose the word forgive, which represented a tool with which I go inside myself and remove my pain, was changed to pardoning, I'm going to let you off the hook because there's pain in me? Why do you suppose that was changed? I'd offer it was changed to disappear forgiveness from the planet. And it's been disappeared for, my offering is the reason the world is in so much turmoil, the reason the political games are going on, the trauma, the drama, right down to starvation, is because people don't know how to remove the creative energies in themselves with which they are creating their own pain, their own trauma, and contributing that trauma to the world around them. And the next piece of the puzzle, a la Ho'oponopono, is based on the understanding I've just shared. One of the things that I've been working toward now for some time is to eradicate the words, I love you, from the vocabulary of the world. Since love is a state of being, not something that we can do to each other, get from each other, give to each other. What happens is, when you utilize the words I love you, you set up an unachievable goal in the mind. That goal leaves the mind with an impossible task, which tends to lead to the deep frustration that so many people experience. And they're just like, oh, I'm not thinking, why? And we've done it to ourselves. And one of the ways that we do that is by setting goals that are unachievable. No one has ever loved you. No one is ever going to love you. You have never loved anyone, and you are never going to love anyone. And the Creator does not love you. Go back and look in the ancient scriptures. It doesn't tell us the Creator loves us. It tells us the Creator is love. Now, Greek misinterpretations turn that around. But our human lives, our very being, is the presence of love. It's not something we do, it's what we are. So this error in changing the meaning of the word love from a noun, something that describes who we are, to a verb, something we do, seems rather innocuous, but it results in huge problems in relationships. Yeshua never instructed us to love the Creator or love our neighbor. The instruction he gave was that of that was mistakenly translated as love. In Aramaic was have rachma when you think of the Creator or your neighbor. And by so doing, you maintained your own human life, love. So the word there was not love, but rather have rachma. So as a result, I never tell anybody that I love them. In fact, when people say I love you, I'll oftentimes say, well, I want you to be clear, I don't love you. And then I'll go on and say, because it's not something I can do to you or give to you. I can bring the presence of my being, love, to you, to our relationship. I can hold to that space, but I can't use the word, accurately use the word love as a verb. So I can offer the truth, that is, that I cherish you, and then the way I fulfill that is by taking responsibility for making sure that I'm living as the presence of love when we interact. Maintaining my human life, whatever somebody else does. And the proper use of words is a major key to living a healthy, happy life. So here's my take on the steps in Ho'oponopono in the light of first century Aramaic teachings of Yeshua. One, in gratitude, even in the midst of my conflict, I choose to remember the place in me that is the same as the place in you, where we are creations of love, connected, and are in fact one. In the invisible, indivisible world, we are important parts of each other, and I cherish you. Albert Einstein had a powerful insight in this regard when he said, if you think you're separate or separated from the rest of humanity, you're living in an optical delusion. It's time for us to get out of the optical delusion and live as the presence of love. And when we have a challenge doing that, put our effort into living as that presence of love. Become subjective. So step two in the process would be I acknowledge and accept responsibility for my error. I apologize, and both now and in the future, I will focus on correction of my error. I ask for guidance in freeing myself from my error, from my errors, and acting from a state of love toward you. Namaste. Step three, let us join in canceling the goals we hold that drives the pain in either of us so that that pain may be uncovered and undone in us, and for all of our generations. Four, I appreciate and cherish you in my life. So I'd suggest you might look at those four steps in place of the I love you, please forgive me, I'm sorry, and thank you. I hope that fits and helps and makes sense. And beyond that, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody else in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
Not at the moment, but I did get a response from her after I sent her those links.
Oh, sweet.
And I'd also sent her the link to where you discussed it on the radio show before, and she says, excuse me, oh my goodness, Michael recorded this message exactly when I needed it. At the end of each sheet, she does the meditation. She says, to strengthen the love in herself and to burn it, quote unquote, to let go of all the flame from the words and the impurities that she had written down on the sheet, her tangled thoughts.
Sweet.
She says, I'm going to go to
good
my
idea.
Forest and cry. She says, I'm going to the forest to cry my good emotions. And I had mentioned to her in the translating to get with Sandy. And excuse me, and talked about,
you inhale,
you know,
something,
that,
honey?
I did. We talked about that, you know, when you translate, you can't just translate the words. And she said, yes, I'm fully aware and responsible for the fact that the words in my language should not be, quote unquote, a dry translation, but should fully convey
Sweet.
Phrases that will reach the hearts of the people in this country in this language. I am a fan of Jung and Plato and ancient philosophy. There I have always been looking for support every day. And then here she says, and I forgive Descartes, because when he wrote, I think, therefore I am, he was 20 years old and was seduced by his idea during the Enlightenment. It was a difficult time,
yes,
after the medieval head cage in Europe. I'll keep working.
He definitely put the
I'll
cart
give you
before
a sign.
The horse.
Yeah. Says, I will give you a sign when I feel like I'm ready to translate. And she is counting on Sandy's help. Love and light.
Sweet. Well, that's awesome. Much appreciation. It'll be fabulous to be able to put that on our website and make it available for anyone that speaks Polish. And by the way, I think what do we have now? 9 or 11 languages on the website, honey? So you can download the free "The Why Is This Happening to Me Again" book in any one of how many?
9 languages.
Nine.
And
nine
they're not
languages.
All complete. Some of them are just partials.
In process, right?
Right.
And the way to get to those translations, if you go to our website, whyagain.org, and in the middle page, you'll see a picture of the book of Why Is This Happening to Me Again. If you click on that and just drill down through the links, you'll find the translations. You can download in English. And unfortunately, we can't sell you a book because it's out of print. However, if you like to have a physical book in English, it has also been translated into Swedish, but I don't know. We might have one or two copies of it left, but it's, as far as I know, out of print now in Swedish. But if you go to the website, click on the book, drill down, you can download in any one of those languages the book free. You can usually find used. We sold enough of them back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, that they're still floating around. So there's usually quite a few used copies for sale on Amazon or on eBay. So please take advantage of it. Put it to work. And if you're out there in Israel, does any of that... Go ahead, Jeannie.
I was just going to say, you now have a hand up.
Awesome. Well, let's say hello.
I believe that it is Peter. Welcome, 619.
Hello,
welcome, sir. How are you? Hey.
Great. How are you doing?
Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear yours again.
How do you be? What's happening?
Well, we've known each other for quite a while, 30 plus years, but I did have a question for you.
Great. I'll do my best to answer it.
Well, for some unknown reason, you appear to always answer it correctly for the last 30 years, so my trust in you is high. Here's the question. I related the story of where some relatives stole a bunch of money from me and my wife in the last 2 years.
Right.
6 figures.
Ouch.
And yeah, ouch. And you asked me to forgive him.
No. Don't ever put those words in my mouth. I would
Don't
never
you
ask you to
that.
Forgive anybody for anything.
Nope. You're right. I said it wrong. I'm still in the old way. The focus was on the thief. And
right.
I did the worksheets on the thief. And I kind of moved on. However, because of all of these funerals I've been going to, I'm meeting other relatives who have had similar experiences with the thief. And they were full of anger. I think you may have picked some of that up when we chatted this weekend. They were full of anger, but none of them had the losses at our level.
Right.
So I'm leading up to a question. I could have
before you get to the question, let me just throw a thought in to see if we can, for everybody, clarify this idea of forgiveness. In every case where the Greeks translate that the man Yeshua said, forgive your brother, or forgive yourself, or forgive somebody, each time that those words were translated, there were two words that were missed. And the two words, and I can remember when I first started to confront this idea, it was a little bit difficult for me to get a hold of with my mind. But in Aramaic, let's say somebody's brother has done something, and Yeshua would not say to that person, forgive your brother. He would say, forgive as to your brother. In other words, I interacted with his brother, and they brought something internal inside of me that was painful up with that action. So I may apply pardoning to my brother for what they've done. Gee, what they did was illegal, immoral, off the wall, terrible, awful, evil, whatever descriptors we want to give it. I'm not applying forgiveness to them for what they did, pardoning perhaps, but I'm applying forgiveness to, I'm forgiving as to what their action brought up in me. And so I can do a worksheet with them as the object of attention, but what I'm working on doing is collapsing the pained perception in myself so that I can get to the root of what that trauma is in me that I'm projecting into my brain's image of that event, and what energetically is part of what invited the event into my space to happen in the first place as a creator. So does that make a little bit of more sense? I think that when the mind gets a hold of that as to, then another level of understanding of the Aramaic forgiveness process comes into view.
Yes, that makes sense. And I kind of felt I worked beyond that. However, because the family members had data, they could contact the FBI and get things done and put things in motion, and I got more data. The money went to pickup trucks and expensive vacations and et cetera. The money's gone now. And when I tried this 2 years ago, I could have prevented the money from being gone. However, my wife did not want me to pursue because she thought her sister walked on water with her fake ministry. So, they actually used the name of Jesus to do all this stuff.
Yeah.
Double knife in the back. So now I'm mad at my wife because she never let me pursue.
I don't believe you have ever been mad at your wife in your life, but you got some mad in there, and you can sure pretend that it's about your wife, but Peter, it's got nothing to do with your wife. That's your mad. I mean, you had that mad long before you ever met your wife, right?
There's a history of not people, but maybe life stealing my stuff.
Yeah.
In there. Really what I'm mad about.
So my offering is you're not really mad about that at all. There's just mad in there, Peter. Remember our definition of denial. Whenever I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of what's moving inside of me, in order to believe that, in order for my mind to produce a construct called perception, the documents that I'm mad about what happened out there, I have to hide from myself the real cause of the anger that's inside of me. I have to drive that dis-ease energy deeper into my own unconscious, into my own tissue structure, so that I can really pretend that my anger is about what's happening out there now today. So I have to dissociate when I go into denial, think or speak as though that's the cause of what's moving in here. I have to literally dissociate from the cause of what's happening inside of me. That's how we create an unconscious mind. And my offering is that an unconscious mind is not natural for us as human beings. We are not designed to have an unconscious mind. We have an unconscious mind because we've been taught to live in denial, to think and speak as though, oh, that made me mad. That's why I'm sad. That's why I'm angry. This is why I'm afraid. And they really peeved me. Now my mind, because my mind is a dedicated servant, a device designed to serve my goals, when I tell my mind they made me mad, I hide the root of my anger from myself and I put it into my brain's image of them. Literally, I project it. You know, the culture talks about projection as taking something that's inside of you and putting it outside of you. Pardon me, but that's not projection at all. That's externalization. When I take something inside of me and pretend it's outside of me, I've externalized it. But projection is when I take, let's say, that anger, and I use that dissociated anger energy to build my brain's image of them. I project that energy from my internal database into my perceptual construct of them. And therefore, I have a picture of them causing my anger. So I really believe it's true, but it's all a fantasy of the mind. Did that progression make sense?
Yes, it does, and it makes me feel like I have some power over this situation if I get out of my head. However, it is still totally 100% real to me right now.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you.
And
remember that forgiveness, you know, a situation like the one you're talking about, when I apply forgiveness to my, let's say I'm enraged, mad about, my mind tells me about what happened, but mad is the energy with which I distort my own mind and my own perception. When I forgive as to that situation and remove my anger, then I'm going to have a much more honest and complete picture of what's going on both inside of me and outside of me. And that's what's going to empower me to step into holding somebody accountable for what they've done. You know, obviously, clearly, what they did was illegal and immoral. Very reasonable for you to hold them accountable for that. And I lament with you that that wasn't the step you were able to take because of the interaction between yourself and your wife, that you weren't able to step up at that moment with the clarity to go, okay, we're doing accountability here. But oftentimes it's the very emotion that we project that inhibits us to see how we can rectify things, because that's part of the false reality, the false construct of the mind.
Yes, and so we went through the funerals. Well, it's one funeral. Well, I had two of them in the last month, but
right.
When this Asian culture, I'll just leave things kind of neutral, their funeral process is four phases. I had to kind of watch and learn.
Right.
There's a phase of denial. And I saw this with the Catholic Italian upbringing, but we did it all in one day, I thought. But here it was 4 days. Catholic denial, complete shutdown. After the wailing and flailing, I guess is what the word is, but and then celebration, So at the end, it turned out something quite beautiful. However, we had to host these 50 people during the entire process, and some of them were sharing information, you know, where you walk out on the sidewalk and say, I just wanted you to know, we all know the story.
So, right.
It was a bittersweet period, and I was even told, your wife knows this story, and she has known it. And that's where phase two of anger came in. How come you didn't tell me so I could take appropriate accountability action? I actually teach accountability with the Department of Defense. Accountability. Who's accountable?
Yeah.
And it just went against my grain.
Yeah. So my invitation would be, and this sounds like probably your next worksheet, would be that you might want to ask yourself why you are blaming her for the fact that you didn't take the action to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
Like, you might want to be accountable for that to yourself.
I stop breathing while I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
Which you taught me a long time ago to monitor. So, please say the worksheet again.
Yeah, I would say there are probably several different worksheets to do here, but the one I'm in particular, as you talk about accountability, notice that you're not willing to be accountable for the fact that you did not take the action with the thief. You want to put that on your wife.
No, I tried to. I contacted the FBI. I contacted the U.S. government. I contacted immigration. And they said, we need this data. And I went to my wife, can I have this data? And she said, no.
Hmm.
They are on top of a mountain teaching about Jesus in the Philippines. And they were literally in Virginia spending money. I felt
breathing
like
with you.
Accountability.
No, but, that's pretty tough.
I even think there's a deeper core issue here is, why am I so gullible in believing people? I'm getting to the point now I don't want to believe in anyone. That's where I'm at. Because...
Are you breathing?
No.
So I didn't let you take a breath into that one.
I was raised in a healthy family where I could trust everyone all the time. And I'm 60-plus years old now, and I keep finding cheats and stealers out there. I don't understand why. My brother, who was a cop, who was wonderful, says, you're gullible. That's why.
So if you remember, and I'd invite you at this point, Peter, to go back and redo the videos that we sent you with the personal code evaluation that you did. Watch those again and take a look at your assignments. And if you remember, go back in your mind when you watched that or when we spoke about it. Your balance of honoring others, self, and truth are lower than, oh, wait a minute, let me just look here.
You said they were all equal.
No. Yeah, they're all three of them are balanced. That's right. And usually, I'm just looking at the whole evaluation to see if we can spot where your most important work would be to get through that one.
Well, it was diet, so to speak.
I'm actually, as I'm looking at your scores, because the honoring of others, self, and truth are in perfect balance, which is pretty rare. I mean, in 40 years of administering that evaluation, I've probably only seen it five times, hundreds of people. And I'm seeing a new piece of it that I hadn't previously recognized, and that is that there's a significantly higher score in your honoring of laws of living, which usually has to do with victimhood. And normally when we see an imbalance between the honoring self and others and then the honoring truth, that's where gullibility comes in. But I'm seeing here that something that just had not really observed before, and I think, I'm not willing to make 100% commitment to it yet, but I think I'm kind of grasping on a new level that with that high score on honoring laws of living, that would kind of tend to act as a way of keeping in blocking seeing what should be obvious to the mind, of skewing the mind so that it's not seeing things in full, in their full meaning. And so I would suggest going back, and I know you've been working on those, but making a renewed commitment to the score or the assignments on honoring others, honoring self, and honoring truth. And I suspect when you bring that up, and normally I would say this when there's a differential between honoring self, others, and then where truth is higher, but here it's laws of living that's higher. And so I'd say a new level of commitment to those three assignments on honoring self, others, and truth, and bring it up to the same level as honoring laws of living, and you're going to get rid of that little twist that the mind gives it of gullibility.
Yeah,
how are you doing with your breath right now?
I'm suffocating.
Okay. So joining you in breathing, my friend.
But yeah. So the work I've been doing for 35 years in America is reading a culture. I can go into a culture, a Walmart, whatever, and say, that guy's going to do this. This will happen here based on the culture. However, when I started teaching in law enforcement, repetitively told by policemen, including my brother who used to be a policeman, who are trained in reading people.
Right.
Boy, you can't read a person at all. Look around this restaurant. What do you see? And I said, a lot of happy people. Culture's good. We're all safe. Now, do you see that guy over there? Do you see this? And the only reason I bring that up is because you mentioned that something, I think you used the word obscure, or used the word, that I can't see that in the person, that I should be able to see.
Right. Gullibility.
And the gullibility. So it's not one policeman that said I'm gullible, it's a lot of them. I said that. It's like you love everybody, and that's not safe. And you have to go to the gun range with me. That's a whole different story. But the point is, I don't know where the gullibility comes from, and that's what I want to get rid of, because I find myself getting hurt by trusting everyone all the time.
So I would offer you ultimately you're going to need to distinguish the difference between, first of all, loving anybody. I don't agree that they're correct that, you know, loving anybody, everybody is dangerous. And the fact that is you can't love anybody anyway, but being love in the presence of everyone is a number one rule for living as a human being. And when I'm in that space of connected love, I'm going to have more contact with truth than I'm going to have if I'm in some form of hostility or fear. And my offering would be to do a renewed level of work on the honoring of self, others, and truth, those challenges on the evaluation. And when you get them up into the arena of or match with the honoring laws of living, then you're going to find that gullibility is going to tend to disappear. It usually comes from having a higher level of honoring truth than it does than the level at which we honor self and others. That's where the gullibility usually comes in. But as you're sharing this, I'm seeing another aspect of it, which is that when I have an out of balance, and when I say out of balance, I just mean a higher level of honoring laws of living than others, self, and truth, then it will tend to contribute to that gullibility. When I bring them all up into a balance with each other, when I bring those three that are lower into balance with laws of living, then the mind skewing me in the direction of gullibility, that aspect is going to disappear, and I'm going to just be able to see things as they are. That's how you're going to clear that one out.
That makes sense. So the more I reconnect with my true self, the more I'll be able to differentiate what's out there and choose.
Yes. Yes. And from love, I mean, you see the criminal in the criminal act, and from a space of absolute, total connected love, you do what's necessary to hold them accountable for it. You know, I learned that way back. You know, the man who originally inspired us to create the prison course, Laws of Living, was a judge. His name was Asa D. Kelly. And Kelly was a Superior Court judge that was probably the closest person I've ever known to being a saint. This guy was in Albany, Georgia, and if you know the state of Georgia, Albany's been described as a part of the body lower than the armpit. I mean, it's a pretty rough area, pretty rough place. And Kelly, sitting on the bench, I mean, he sent thousands of people to prison for, you know, long, long stretches of time, but he never punished one of them. He always did it out of a connected space of love, and he would explain to them, I mean, some, you know, really heinous backwood type crimes, and he'd explain to them, you know, using the language of the culture, I love you like a brother, but you're not safe in this community, and this community has taken up a collection. This is what he'd actually say to people. This community's taken up a collection and built a building with bars around it and asked me to determine who's safe in the community and who isn't. And because I care for my community, I'm going to sentence you to life in prison because you're not safe in my community. There was no punishment in him whatsoever, and it was out of that space of connectedness and love that Laws of Living grew, that Dan and I really created the Laws of Living course to create a support system for the healing of people who would commit crimes such as that. And, I mean, we cut recidivism in the prison system by over 90%. The accountability was there. We administered for Judge Kelly what was called a pretrial release program. And Kelly would, you know, people who came before him and were adjudicated responsible for a crime, he would turn them over to us. He would ask them, if they wanted to do a program of recovery, he'd turn them over to us, and we'd do this evaluation, show them where their blocks were. Kelly would look at that, and depending what the scores were, if the scores were in the right profile, he'd put this person out on pretrial release. If they didn't have the right kind of profile where they could be trusted to stay in on the right side of the law, then he'd keep them in jail and sentence them to Laws of Living And when their profile shifted that showed that they were not likely to commit a crime again, he'd let them out on pretrial release. And he would set up a contract with them. I mean, as a judge, of course, got a lot of power. He would set up a contract. Generally, it was a three-year contract. And if you sign this contract, I have total power over your life. Basically, I can send a police officer in anytime I want to your home, to your work. You'll surrender to blood tests. Most of them were drug and alcoholics. You'll surrender to blood tests. And, you know, so like for that three-year period, he had total power over the lives. And if you do this work and your scores on the evaluation reflect it, after 3 years, if you're crime-free, I will expunge your record. And he did that out of caring and concern for the people who, in his community, had committed some pretty heinous crimes. But basically, it was about converting people back to a mind that was connected to love rather than the hostility and fear-based mind that they'd been beaten into as kids and, you know, generationally trapped in, because that's how the family system worked. That's how the culture worked. You know, that's the whole basis of this work, right from the get-go.
That's impressive.
So I suggest going back and redoing those videos with the assignments and getting really clear once again on what the assignment is on honoring self, honoring others, and honoring truth, and really work those three areas and the assignments for them, and that's going to bring your score up into alignment with where your higher score is with honoring laws of living, and I think you'll find that your mind then, gullibility just disappears, and you go, oh, here's what.
Okay.
It's true.
I may call you this week to review this conversation and where to go exactly. I do know that when I do the work you recommend, it always works quite quickly.
That works. Yeah.
And
well, before you set up a time for us to get together again, before we do another session, what I suggest is watch those videos first with your assignments and really get a handle on those, and then that would make our time in a session most productive.
Okay, so the videos are the ones I got in the email with the results of the test, yes, no?
Right. Right. When you got the results, Jeannie included links, I think, to two different videos that explain the personal code evaluation and what the scoring means and what the assignments are that go with each one. It gave word links and mind shifters and, you know, a whole set of assignments for each area of the evaluation that you had challenges with.
Okay. Final question. So I
go
did
for
this
it.
Work 35 years ago, and I took off 30 years and did something else, whatever, jogging, running.
Glad you're back.
Is it usual that all this crap is going to pop up as soon as I start this work?
Well, you know, one of the things that I see all the time is people will say, well, you know, I got this challenge, that challenge, physical, what have you, and you know, but life is pretty good. And they live at a level where they keep their vitality down, which means they can keep everything hidden from themselves that they don't deal with. And they do it with junk food, they do it with hostility, and they do it with drugs, and they do it with alcohol. When somebody says, I'm going to go to work now, and makes a commitment, they automatically create an increase in vitality. And then when they actually step in and start to do the things, like drop the things they've been anesthetizing themselves with, and start doing more and more of the things that are on track, then they build vitality. Once you build vitality, then what you've been hiding from yourself is going to start to show up in your physiology, in your emotions, and in your world. And rather than staying hidden, you'll remember in the ancient scriptures, he said, nothing will remain hidden. Everything will be made known in the light of day. It's all going to play out. If you keep lowering your vitality, like most people are are in a process of dying. They play the game of, I drug myself, I anesthetize myself, I eat all the junk food I can, I use as much alcohol as I can, or I use drugs in order not to feel, and they are deteriorating physiologically, mentally, and emotionally. Once you start to reverse that, then you start to get to look at what you've been hiding from yourself. It's just part of the healing process. You know, the mind has a built-in suppress mechanism. The mind-body actually has a built-in suppress mechanism. So if I'm, let's say, we've got a vitality meter, and it goes from 1 to 10, and I'm at a level 5 vitality, if I've got a level 6 toxic issue, a level 7, a level 8, a level 9, a level 10, my mind's going to keep that hidden from me. That's not coming to light. It's going to be hidden from me. Because if I were to, let's say, surface and start to move through, let's say, a level 7 toxic situation when I'm only at a level 5 vitality, literally the release of the toxicity of that could physiologically kill me. Cancel the thought. So when I start to do my work, you know, I drop off the anesthetics, I start to eat more cleaner dietary regimen, I do that, I breathe, I do things that make me more vital, I build my vitality, I move from a 5 to a 6, and I say, hey, I'm feeling pretty good. I like this. This is good. I get to a 6.5, and hey, it's getting better every day. Man, I feel great. I get to a 7. This is really, I mean, I'm rocking. And then, you know, I get to a level 7.5, and I'm on top of the world. This is just fabulous. I go to bed at night. I mean, I am flying like a kite. And in the morning, I wonder if anybody got the number of the Mack truck that went through my room during the night, because I'm lower than a snake's belly. What happened? When I hit that level 7.5 vitality, all of the level 7, 6, 5 that I could not deal with previously, now it's going to be up in my face. You know, it's like the body-mind being says, hey, we got enough vitality to process through this one. Okay, let's let it move. Otherwise, most people are just moving on a downward trend toward death and never get to see that stuff. They just die from it.
This makes total sense. This makes, and we talked when I was in Hawaii for 2 weeks vacation. That Mack truck that hit me, you just
it's just part of the process.
It took me 3 days to recover from that Mack truck, so to speak.
Yeah, I hear you. And 3 days and is about average for most people.
Say again?
I'd say 3 days when something starts to break loose, 3 days is pretty much a norm for people to, that are doing their work to move through a set of toxic upheaval that the structure is going through, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, financial, relational, it plays out in any arena.
Yeah, that's what it took me. Well, that has been most beneficial today. We'll catch up again. I didn't mean to take over your radio show, but
No, this isn't just for you, Peter. This is everybody. I mean, you're not the only one who's benefiting from this conversation. This is all of us. So I'm delighted to spend as much time with as many questions as you have. And, you know, the fact that you're doing your work means that it opens a space for everybody to understand on another level. So that's the purpose of the radio show.
Okay.
That's why we be here.
Well, love you, Michael. I'll sign off, and I know you have to close your show. So,
okay, well, I don't believe for a minute that you love me. I don't believe for a minute that you love me, and I'll assure you that I don't love you either, but I am committed to being the space of love in our connection, in our relationship.
What does that mean?
That means that, well, let's go back and think about the first time. Do you remember the first time that you held your newborn daughter?
Yes. And my son, yes, both.
Okay, well, go back to either of them and remember the moment at which you first held them. Like, actually, you might even physically put your arms in the place where you would be holding that child. Go back to the moment where you held them and tap into the essence of either your son or your daughter or both of them. And what word would you assign to that essence?
Unconditional love.
Okay. Now, again, breathing, holding them, tapping into them, are they loving you or are they love?
Well, they don't know me, so I guess they are love. I don't know.
Yeah.
They are love.
So that's the fact. That's the fact of what human life is. It is love. Now, you'll notice we live in a culture that specializes in beating out of us the awareness that we are love. And then at a certain age, they send us out the front door and say, now, go find somebody to love or go find somebody to love you. And now the cheap and venial copy that the ego has of love, that is approval, becomes the pursuit. Oh, I find somebody that I approve of. I approve of them because they're eye candy to me. I approve of them because they bring up good feelings in me. I approve of them because. But you'll notice that in that circumstance, that when that person violates a goal that's held by the person supposedly loving them, notice how quickly love can turn to disapproval and hate in an instant, because it was never love in the first place. So my support for you and everybody on this show and everybody that I work with and for myself as well is that we each experience ourselves once again as the presence of active love, and we move through the world as love rather than reducing who we are to this venial approval game of I love you that we step into. And the goal then becomes, you know, for me personally, in my own personal process, my primary purpose in that regard is to live in connectedness to who I am as love with any and everybody that I interact with, no matter what they're doing, and to inspire the same in them, and to get rid of this false venial idea that I could possibly love you. I can't love you. You can't love me. Love isn't a verb. It's not something we do to each other. It's what we are. So the goal becomes functioning as who we are rather than playing the game of approval. Oh, if you do what I like you doing, then I'll approve of you. And there you get to understand why Yeshua says you want to be that space of love for anybody that you look at. The most heinous of actors, you want to remember to maintain your own human life in their presence. And if you can't, then the actions they do will show you what it is in you that needs to be forgiven that keeps you out of your eternal presence in your own life as love.
Well, that makes sense.
That makes sense? Cool.
Total sense.
Well, holding the space, my friend.
Holding the space. I love that sentence. So thank you, Doctor.
All right. Take care. Blessings. Everybody, thank you for joining us. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give.